Welcome to the Linux Slugcast, episode 80. We are an open podcast slug that meets at 9 p.m. Eastern every first and third Friday of the month using Mumble. If you'd like to join us, please visit linuxslugcast.com for the server details. We also have a Mumble how-to on the site explaining how to configure Mumble. Then just join us in the Linux Slugcast room. During the live show, if you are unable to join us in Mumble, you can listen to us streaming live. You can also join us on IRC. On Freenode, it's #LinuxSlugcast. If you have any questions, comments, or topics you'd like us to discuss, please email us at feedback@linuxslugcast.com. We also have a Google Plus community site and a mailing list. Visit our website for the direct links. I am Honky Magoo, and with us tonight is Mr. 5150.
Howdy, folks.
And Netminer.
Hello, friends.
So, I should have looked at it before the show, but I don't remember seeing any feedback.
That's what I was going to ask. I don't really recall any offhand. And folks in the IRC, you know, feel free to check us on this. You wrote something in that, you know, this is the time to wave your hand.
There was something that it seems like somebody from Vlad Schwetz. It seems like he was trying to promote his application of Vector. It's a Vector graphics editor. Did you see that one?
No, I must have skipped that one.
I'll just read it out real quick. I've seen you covering some cool Ubuntu apps and thought you'd definitely be curious learning about Vector. Vector is a free, forever, and intuitive Vector graphics editor. It's already been available online and on Mac, Windows, and Chromebook. We've packaged the app now using the new Snap formats to bring it to Ubuntu, and we're super excited for millions of Ubuntu users to try it out. We put all the relevant info about Vector and some graphics into a Medium Media Kit, and it gives a link. You'll also find their cool banner, blah, blah, blah. Command line install would be sudo snap install vector. Would be awesome if you would cover us briefly. Pretty sure Ubuntu and your audience users are going to find our app super useful. Lab.
If you can copy at least that link in under listener feedback, that way it'll make it easier for people to find it.
What, for the media kit?
Yeah, or the download. Well, I guess download, you just app get. Well, no, it's a Snap. I still don't understand Snap apps. And somebody was saying the other day, Ubuntu, all the graphical package managers in Ubuntu now default to using Snap to install stuff rather than Aptitude or apt-get. So that's just a little background information. So Ubuntu sort of doubled down on Snap, so I guess it's something we'll have to learn eventually. Yeah, probably to his website or the SDK or whatever. Or you put in the whole feedback if you want. It's not that long.
Yeah, I think I should probably do a quick Google search on the application and see if I can pull their website up. Probably best. You know, too bad Fweeb isn't on, because Fweeb is, you know, all about the graphic editors and stuff like that. I mean, he would probably have either seen this or used it before or have some sort of a much better opinion of it than you or I.
Okay, well, while you're doing that, I'll start with my topics. And there's a lot of makery things in this tonight, guys. And not... Oh, I think they're close enough to Linux-related to not be objectionable. That could be debatable, but I, as much as we talk about mini computers in this show, I think there's a lot of overlap. This first one is really, really, a lot of people may actually be offended by me including this because it's a project by Paul Allen through HISS. I think it's a really cool picture. He's sort of got this huge twin boom jet that's supposedly the biggest aircraft in the world, and it is designed to air launch orbital platforms into orbit. In other words, rather than Elon Musk, you know, firing off his rocket from a platform in the ocean. He's going to, just like they dropped the X-15 and the Bell X-1, things like that, you know, he's going to use this plane to take him up in the stratosphere and then, you know, drop launch him from there, because it's a lot more energy efficient to get him up that high on a air-breathing winged aircraft. So, listen, it's a cool picture. You know, you can hate me if you want. Next thing, I ran across this company from a video on YouTube. I'll talk a little bit that below. This is a really makery type firm that is basing stuff on their own version of Arduino. They're called a Coinduino because the guts of the board, the processor actually fits inside the circumference of a coin. And there are a couple of these I've already bought and invested in, but you make really, really tiny Arduino projects, Arduino style projects, and every component is stackable. The ones I've gone with three that are pre-made, but if you look, you can see where they are based on, the individual boards that you can see on the same page. First one's a tiny arcade. I think I mentioned last week, might have been after show, but I came to the realization this Qbert mini console that's about 5 inches high, mini arcade machine that I bought at Walmart. I was looking at it and said, well, if I cut the screen window out, I could easily place that 3x5 monitor that I got for the portable router project and put the Raspberry Pi in behind there and still have room for the battery I was thinking, well, that's going to stick out the bottom, make it look obvious when I get on an airplane. There's a lithium battery in there that's a separate component. I get all this stuff in that case, and I was thinking about, make my own tiny arcade machine with RetroPie, replace the joystick and stuff with better components. And then it hit me. Well, if I'm thinking of doing that, taking it on the plane, by swapping out the SD card, I could easily make it both the travel router and the travel arcade. So I only mentioned that because this company, tinycircuits.com, they make their own tiny arcade machine that's about two-thirds the size of the one I bought in Walmart. So it's about 3 inches tall. Now I already have several games for it. None of them are actually licensed versions, but they are clones of your classic old arcade games like Space Invaders. They call theirs Tiny Invaders. And probably if anybody wanted to push the point, they might be in trouble. It's got an SD card slot. It comes with several games, but you can download more and put them on an SD card. And you can also write your own games. So I am thinking, there's a racing game in there. I'm thinking, well, if we can do that, maybe I could write my own version of Spy Hunter. Of course, for licensing reasons, rather than putting the Peter Gunn theme in the game itself, probably what I'd have to do is, put the Peter Gunn theme on a video on YouTube in a loop on one of my other machines while I'm playing it. The other, and this Vector I'll have to look at that. Maybe I could do my own version of Battle Zone, which I would let, you know, you give me those two games and I will sit there and play it all day long to the detriment of everything else, I guarantee you. So the second product they had is the Tiny Saber, which was, okay, that's neat. It, you know, it's sort of like a little box with wands sticking out of it, and the wands covered with LEDs, and you can tap it and you can change it, you know, the color of the LEDs or the pattern or whatever. Well, that's okay. Don't know if I want to spend $25 for that, but things sold me on that, on this. It does persistence of vision, so you can program in, or well, you can't yet, but you will be able to program in, you know, phrase or whatever, and it's got gyro and accelerometer and all that stuff built in, so it will do persistence of vision. So you could wave this thing in the air, and you could have an it, you know, you could have floating in the air linuxlugcast.com. I'm thinking that would be a great promotional tool for conventions. Now, I know that might be too long. I might have to do smlr.us or something like that. tilts.org, and hope they find us from there. But you know, I think even hackerpublicradio.org might be too long for this. But I you know, they say they're going to post the instructions. I found out at PenguinCon, you know, with the Arduino badge devices and the difference between something like an Arduino and something like a Raspberry Pi. Raspberry Pi, you can get right in the interface, program, you know, change stuff. Whereas, oh, embedded system, that's not the right thing, but a device like an Arduino, to change what it does, you plug it into USB and you use a program on your computer to, you know, to flash the flashable memory on the device to, you know, change the program and give it a new purpose. So you've got one program running all the time, and then you override it and change it to, you know, tweak it here and there, and save, you know, save the changes and then flash it to the device. So the device itself really not a be hard pressed to call the computer. You could probably add peripherals to it and make it a sort of computer, but that's not really what it's designed for. The third one, and this is just another take on the video game, rather than, it uses the same screen, I believe, but rather than having this big clear plastic mini console, really you just have the screen on this bar. On either end of the bar is a joystick. So you get with this, you get twin joysticks. I think you also have buttons and stuff. I think it plays exactly the same games, but you've got a better controller setup and a much more compact design. I mean, you could easily carry this in your pocket. This is be about the size of a watch face with two joysticks. And yeah, a little outside the scope of this podcast, but we have done makery stuff before. All this stuff is open source, so I'm calling Audible and saying that it is within the purview of this podcast. So if anybody thinks that was a wrong decision to make, you know, we do have feedback, so you can be part of the feedback next week. How I came across this it was a YouTube video, but they originate from a new Adam Savage maker site called tested.com, So if you're into that kind of stuff, a lot of the videos that they've done is they've gone to this really, really cool maker conference and just talked to everybody. And so Tiny Circuits is one of the vendors. There's a guy who is, if you remember the old Visible V8 models that were available when we were kids, that you could put, glue together. There's a guy, who's 3D printing third scale engines. So what he's doing is instead of, making clear plastic, I don't know if you even print clear plastic, I've never seen it. He's doing cutaways. So, like I said, nothing really to do with Linux, but man, it's neat. And a lot of people listening may be interested in 3D printing. I sent a link to that to Flying Rich. I thought he would get off on that. Also, there's a new makers podcast out there on the Podnuts Network. They've just done an initial episode, but I expect good things from them. You may have heard them talk about it on the later episodes of the Mini PC show. So it's called The Makers with a Z, and there's a link to that in the show notes. So, said it's not all to this point, none of the stuff is technically directly Linux related, so I'll see if there's any comments or anything, but I don't know if we can spend a whole lot of time discussing it.
I was looking at that little the Tiny Circuits, which one was this? The Tiny Arcade. I'm trying to figure out whether that's even usable.
Definitely, it's going to be on the small side. I think a lot of this stuff, it's cool to pull out and show your friends, but are you going to spend hours sitting there using it? I don't know.
So how usable is the little Qbert machine that you bought?
It's not bad. I mean, if you're a big fan of Qbert, I was never that big a fan. I probably like it better than the alternatives, Asteroids and the Centipede and yeah, I mean Centipede and oh, what was the third one? But and all the rest of those are in black and white. So frankly, I haven't touched it much since the evening I brought it home. But I've probably got better games available to me, but I can see myself playing with it.
But it was functional, like it was usable. It doesn't, like, I don't know. It was, I've seen some of these little machines, and I wonder how long I could actually use it, or how I would actually use it without my hand cramping up, one, and two. It's so it's an arcade box. So how would you rest the box on your lap and then use the little controllers, or?
Yeah, it's only one joystick, so I'm pretty much like holding one hand, and the joystick's on the left side of the box, so using my left hand, the left fingers to control to actually run the controls.
It's a very cool little kit, though.
Yeah, I really think the one with the dual joysticks might be well, I mean, you can carry it anywhere and just pull it out and play it. And play a game, but it was like $79. So I thought, yeah, I knew I wanted the other two. So yeah, maybe wait before we get the third one.
Well, Linux is always a great host for makerist type outboard accessories, so I think it's a great thing to support. One of the guys that I follow did a maker type project, and he was able to transmit data over, I think, 200 kilometers using this long range but low bit rate spread spectrum protocol. Yeah, it's a line of sight protocol that for a lot of these Internet of Things devices.
All right, 50, was there anything else?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about exploit that allowed the WannaCry attack on Windows is out there in any version of Samba. So if you're running a Samba share on your network, you're going to want to patch your computers. Now, I've seen some more alarmist ones that says, well, you need to block the port for Samba, the particular article that I linked doesn't talk about that, but I'm certain it would be easy enough to do. Now, what I'm thinking of is, would that even be necessary unless you're remoting into the machine, using the Samba protocol? Because, it says block the port. Well, if there's nothing on your network listening on that port on your router, in other words, you're not port forwarding that port to a machine that's running Samba, I don't see, how it could be exploited. Somebody could probably educate me more on that. But definitely, yeah, if you're running a Samba share and it is on a Linux box and it is, visible to the web, definitely you need to read up on this, get all your machines patched. Looks like they'd have to jump through a lot of hoops and get real lucky. Because what they can do, I guess there's a special executable about down the middle of the article. Special executable called a shared object, so it would have a .so extension. And they can get that and write it to your Samba share thing with this exploit. Thing is, then they would have to execute it, and for that, they've got to make a pretty good guess about the path to your Samba share. I guess there are several standards for that. So if you're doing something, standard, then they might be able to, then they could do remote code execution. So if they get lucky, or do some sort of brute force attack or something like that, and hit the path to that file, then they could execute it, and then whatever's in, through Samba, and then whatever that code would be, would be executed. Yeah, NK Wisher in the chat says anyone at open Samba to the web deserves to be hacked. I agree with you, K. Wisher. So be aware of that. Patch your machines. I have a small Samba share, and it's just because it's not bigger, because Samba would not follow a symbolic link to the larger drive. So I do have a little Samba share locally on my network, so that if I could, if I connect a Windows machine, I can copy over antivirus malware bytes. I could copy FABs auto backup, stuff like that. Stuff is small. So, but I don't, it's definitely not exposed to the web, so I don't see how it's a vulnerability, but I'll still make sure everything gets backed up. So just throwing that out there. If there was anybody didn't know that was possible, now you do know. The criminal part of this is the NSA has known about this vulnerability for years. I don't know if this is part of the Snowden revelations, but apparently, some black hats have discovered it, made it work. So that NSA, as soon as they knew it was out there, they contacted Microsoft and told them how to patch stuff. But of course, this was after several several places like hospitals and other institutions got hacked, lost all their information, all their backups, and you know, were in the position of having to either lose everything or settle with terrorists, essentially. So, I think that's just another black mark of many on the NSA, and I'm sure they don't care what my opinion is.
I wanted to mention that I've heard that that wine is also an area where WannaCry can get onto your system or get through somehow. I'm not sure how patchable wine is.
Right, but you shouldn't, you know, you should not be saving critical documents to your wine partition. I imagine there's some people probably do because they're using that to talk to their Windows machines, and the Windows machines need to see that information. But you know, my opinion, wine, there should just be stuff. Of course, I guess if you have games, you know, maybe you lose all your game backups. I don't think that's probably worth paying ransom for, but definitely you should not have your password file or your financial information or anything like that on the C volume of a wine installation. And you're right, Netminer. I believe wine is essentially NT, or not NT, but XP. So. Yeah, there's, of course, Microsoft did release a, you know, this was so critical that they did release a patch for XP. Now, you know, that could be somehow applied to wine or not, I don't know. The other thing I want to talk, and I've talked about this, and I should have really done more with it in intervening period. I do have Freedom Box now set up on my BeagleBone Black, and I decided to do that running my Pine Box because looked at it and there's not a build for the Pine Box, but should be able to install Debian on it, and then install Freedom Box on Debian. I didn't really see any there's probably one Debian without a graph, without a GUI. I think there was one I had there for, but I just thought what I'd been thinking was, well, maybe running all these servers in the background if you chug a BeagleBone. But then I realized, well, you're not running the GUI on top of it because it's a web interface. I mean, it's meant to be a headless system. You do all the configuration, by hitting the IP, from another computer and loading up the web interface. And I've got the reason I wanted to do it was to set up a VPN, you know, in talking with Dan Fry about, you know, and he's doing all the hard lifting on the portable router project. I haven't really done anything on that. I'm just following his footsteps. But, and we've mentioned this on the show before, but to recap, a lot of hotels, they block things like Netflix and other streaming services. So if you want to use this to, you're carrying around a Chromebox and whatever, and you wanted to go through your VPN and at home and use your Netflix account and stream, or rather, if you're not using your VPN and you want to stream Netflix, apparently a lot of hotels will block the streaming services. And if you want to get around that with the VPN, a lot of your hotels will block the online VPN services where you're paying for somebody else to run your VPN server. And so I wanted to test, Well, they're probably doing that by IP, so maybe they won't be able, you know, they won't, unless they're sniffing protocols somehow, which they could be doing, I guess. You know, what if I set up a home VPN server? And this open box, to recap, we talked about it 2 weeks ago. It's meant to be this really easy, configurable web services type system that you can put on your network. And once you get it set up, you can log into it remotely and set up all kinds of web servers. I'll go through the list here. And, you know, rather than messing around with putting the VPN on my main server, I thought, well, this sounds like a real quick and quick and dirty way to do it. Okay, I got to go back to the right page. Give me just a minute.
This is definitely a DMZ application if you're going to, if you're thinking that way. You want this on a outer ring network, perhaps not even on your primary network where all your big stuff is.
Yeah, I think that's probably a good idea, and that's something else I've been working on setting up through pfSense. Still haven't made much more progress on that, but maybe there'll be a bit more stuff out there. But you know, there's Tor network, BitTorrent, and it's using, if you remember, oh, several weeks ago, I went through setting up the web version of transmission on my server. This is essentially a point-and-click version of doing that. BitTorrent web client through Deluge. Block Sandbox for Mindtest. So I don't know. Some of these are meant to be local. Calendar and address book through Radical. And as I said, what that does, it's a lot like Google Calendar, but if you don't want Google to know your personal calendar, you can set up clients on your systems and set up Android apps to talk to this Radical server. So, you know, you'd be able to share your calendar across all your devices. But it would, it would be locally hosted. Chat client, JSXC, chat server, eJabberd. I don't think these are really IRC, but they are chat clients of the type. Email client, RoundCube, if you've ever signed up for a webmail service before Gmail, you probably are familiar with RoundCube. Gobby server, Infonode, I'll look that up. We talked about that during the session, but I forget what it was. IRC client, Quassel, already have that. On the DigitalOcean droplet. Newsfeed reader, tiny RSS, SIP server repo. When I'm trying to install OpenVPN, and I've done that and it's failed twice. Now that's the trouble with these one-click install sort of things. I mean, if it doesn't want to install, then what do you do? Voice chat, Mumble, so you set up a Mumble server. Web proxy, which is through privacy. Wiki and blog through IKI Wiki. So that's what it's got now. There'll probably be more stuff in the future. So yeah, I've gone through the process of getting it installed. Looking on my router on the pfSense box, and it shows up in the routing table as Freedom Box. Then it was easy to use the router to put it on a static IP address. If you're a server, you want a static IP. And then log into it and set up a username and password. And Matt, the next thing I did was, because I wanted to have something to talk about for the lug, was try to get OpenVPN installed. And it has, so I've tried that, rebooted, tried it again. Let's see. Errors. Okay. Well, no, actually, this is different. Error during installation, dpkg is interrupted. You must manually run sudo dpkg space dash dash configure space dash a to correct problem. Okay. Well, I can do that now since I've created a username and password. I think just plugging in a monitor, logging in directly, though something in the wiki said they're not going to enable sudo on any of the local logins very soon. So there may be a way to SSH into the I'm certain there's a way to SSH into the box. If none of the local accounts have that option, I guess that wouldn't be any better. And then there's options for maintenance and updates to the box.
I have a question. When you talk about establishing a static IP, do you do a true static or do you use a static DHCP?
Static DHCP. I could certainly get in. Well, I don't know. I guess it sounds like they don't want you to do any local configuration on the box. They want you to do it through the web client. So, it hadn't switched the configuration page.
I found static DHCP seems to be the way that's preferred even on pfSense, because everybody talks DHCP if you're not utterly embedded.
Okay, yeah, they're okay. It's got Let's Encrypt to give it a certificate. I'm here in the configuration now. So when I first, my browser wouldn't let me continue when I first went in, and I had to do an exception for self-signed certificate. So we get it, chicken before the egg. I guess you can't get there unless you do that, but you could go in. Let's see. I'm just looking to see what's under configure. Just host name, domain name, and the language. So I was hoping that would be like IP, stuff like that. There is bind domain name server, so I guess that might be the way to do it directly on the box. Dynamic DNS client, firewall, and that might be what, if you run a firewall, that might be a way not to have it not on the outer ring. Let's see. Well, here's network, so I bet from there I can change the IP, or can I? Doesn't seem obvious. Of course, cycle power from here, which is what I did when I rebooted. Public visibility, security, service discovery, snapshots, software upgrades, of course, and users and groups, so you could add other users. So I don't see anything right here. It looks like, drop down to a terminal from the web interface. Again, it always says SSH in, but sounds like at some point they're not going to let you have much super user access from the terminal. Okay, so I really haven't gotten into this that much. Hope, Hopefully by next week I'll fix this problem. Unfortunately, I won't know about the Netflix. You see, I was hoping to do that while I was still going to convention, so I could, you know, put a VPN client on a laptop and see if that would work. Because you can't really do it with the phone because it's already got, you know, if you tell it to go to Netflix, it's going to do it directly. You know, or the cell network, right? You know, it's not even going to think about, oh, I need to jump through the VPN. So there might be a way to force it. So somebody's going to definitely probably send in, no, you go in here and this is how you force it, to, everything to go through the VPN rather than through the cellular network. I've just scratched the surface. And you know, and like I said, what I've tried so far has not been successful, so we'll see if it is, because the whole reason of this is to be able to set these things up quick and dirty, or at least quick, without having to go through a bunch of manuals to figure out each individual package. Okay, well, I've probably used 500 words to say 50 words worth of content, so but I think that was all the topics I had for this evening.
Nemeyer, do you have anything you wanted to add before we close this thing out?
No. The IBM project has been quiet that I was following, so nothing there, and I haven't done anything spectacular personally. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming, and 50. Remember, a lot of your input was the majority of this show. So if we didn't let you talk, we'd have no show. So don't be so hard on yourself.
Well, the remedy for that is for everybody to bring so many topics I can't get in a word in edgewise.
Yeah, I personally haven't had much of a chance to really work on anything. That, and I've been distracted by playing retro games. Alrighty, if we don't have anything else, our next recording date is June 16th, 2017. Our music is Downright, provided by Klaatu and Brome. We want to thank Tony Bemis from the Sunday Morning Linux Review for our web hosting, WordPress support, and our email list server. And we want to thank Delwyn for providing the Mumble server we use, and for creating a bot module so that when you're in IRC, all you have to do is, well, in our channel in IRC, all you have to do is type in .ns in the command line, and it will give you the date for our next show recording. Well, I have been Honky Magoo, and with us was 5150.
So long, folks.
And Netminer.
Good night, folks.
Good night.
Evening, everyone. I guess it's just honky so far.
Yep.
Haven't seen any traffic on Voxer, so do we know the status of anybody yet?
Well, I'm not expecting Father Finch, and I don't know about Fweeb, so.
How's my level? Is that okay?
Yeah, you started off a little low, but you sound great now.
Yeah, you too. I don't know what. Maybe something's adjusted in the back end on the Mumble server. All before the show starts, but something I've been wanting to bring up for discussion has absolutely nothing to do with show topics. I just think it's cool. I guess the long-range plans for Star Wars World in Florida the Disney World. Sounds like it could be more like a Star Wars resort. I mean, you pick your identity in the Star Wars universe before you go in, and you either join the New Order or the Rebellion, or the Resistance, rather. And then the first thing you do when you get there, it is sort of a well, I think the only rides they're talking about for each one is this first thing that you go in. I know if you only do it once, but it's sort of a test. So if you go in as the Resistance, you get to fly the Millennium Falcon. And if you crash the Millennium Falcon, you'll be wearing a badge that everybody can see electronically, especially the staff, so that they will, you know, if you crash the Millennium Falcon for the rest of the stay, they'll treat you like you're a loser. Or if you, you know, if you shoot down everything and win the engagement, then you're the hero. And similarly, if you were join the New Order, you are on kind of a ride thing. I'm guessing where you're shooting in the middle of a firefight. I mean, you'll be on a ride vehicle, so it's not like you just go walk around the middle of this animatronic firefight. But there will be, you know, full size characters, you know, in the ride moving around. So, and I assume that you'll. They haven't said. I assume that, you know, how good you do in this fight depends, you know, is what contributes to your reputation through the rest of the experience. Now, you see a couple things. I mean, you know, first, this has definitely got to be an adult experience. I don't think this is something kids will understand. Secondly, you know, for something like that, how much is it going to cost? Like $1,500 a weekend? So, you know, the people who are losers for the rest of the weekend, how are they going to respond to spending $1,500 on that? And there's only two rides in the whole thing so far, and you can only pick one or the other.
Well, this sounds a lot like a Star Wars LARPing. Is it? And apparently it's supposed to be hosted by Disney. Now, is this related to a couple weeks back? You brought something very similar where it was more hotel orientated, but the way you were talking last time about that was more excuse me, out west, like California somewhere. You were talking something about a hotel that was very similar, or is this basically that?
Okay, this is that. I forgot I'd brought it up already. Well, it must have been after the show last time.
I was before the show a couple weeks back, a month or so back.
I think I just heard about it then. Okay. I saw another video from another YouTuber talking about it the other day, and I was like, did I ever bring that up? I should ask first. But no, this is going to be in the in Florida. The one in California is going to be something completely different.
Yeah, see, that doesn't sound very very reasonable to me. I mean, if you screw up on a simulation at the beginning, you're going to be treated poorly. I don't see the Disney staff treating people poorly, you know. I couldn't see it going that way. I think that's more outlandish speculation than reality, though. I think they might try to create some sort of immersive, but they'd have to create something where it's also very kid friendly, because that's where you're going to get a lot of your money from is from the kids. You know, I mean, we're people like us would think something like that is cool, but because we grew up with that. But at the same time, you might be a little bit more hard pressed to find people like us who would actually spend the money to go down it to it. One of the big things being spousal approval. like, I would think that's cool, but there's no chance I'm gonna convince my wife to take a vacation, to spend a buttload of money to go do this to something that she isn't gonna necessarily like. So
yeah,
I
can see that. I mean, I would like to someday see both parks again, because I was really, I think, too young to really remember much and enjoy them when I went when I was, you know, 10 or 12 years old. But you know, there's the whole creepy thing, 50-year-old man with no kids going to Disneyland.
Right. Disney's with the Star Wars universe seems to be kind of pushing for the younger audience, but still trying to keep their older audiences engaged, because they're pushing for, like, they have the animated series. What is it? Rebels and Clone Wars, I believe. I think the only one I've seen is Clone Wars, and I've heard about Rebels. I've never actually watched it. And then they have the the newer movies coming out, where they seem to be pushing. You know, they'll push the merchandising line for the younger audience, but at the same time, they're still trying to, at least from what I got out of that movie, they're still trying to keep the movie more geared towards the fans who grew up with it, or, you know, at least somewhere in that general verse. It seemed to be more for the movies, in my opinion, still seem to be more for the adults. At least I'm not going to show my kids to it. My oldest is 4, so, you know, that's, you know, there's still a lot of things that might be, you know, not big for the younger audience, but, you know, when the younger audience might be more introduced to it through something like Clone Wars or Rebels.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Clone Wars, though I didn't get to see it till, you know, very, very late on when they put it back, you know, they hit it on network TV. I frankly don't understand, you know, why they ended that and then jumped into Rebels, because it seems to me like it's exactly the same thing with different characters. I haven't seen Rebels yet. That's pretty much stuck on the Disney Channel. And I can rant about these walled gardens on cable at a different, more appropriate time, because I think cable's going away, and eventually you're going to get a package like Hulu or something that you get everything. Even my dad, and it was old, Clone Wars was always on at like 12:30 on Sunday. Dad was always like, "No, put the game on." I said, "Look, you're gonna sit there and watch 8 hours of football, you know, all afternoon. I am gonna watch this 1 hour thing while I'm having my lunch. All right?" So, and he would watch it. He would say, you know, if we had had this when I was a kid, you know, people would just lost their minds, you know, because we didn't have anything like the production quality of this stuff.
Okay, production quality. I was going to say, if he was talking about just because of the, because there is a certain level of maturity still in the Clone Wars show, but I mean, like, the old Hanna-Barbera's had a lot of that too. In my opinion, they're to create a whole Star Wars themed park, they're definitely going to have to make it so it is all age friendly. I mean, they can't just go the whole LARPing route, or at least not to that extent that you were talking about, where, like, people are judged too harshly. I don't think that judging people by something that they played kind of goes against, I think, the whole Disney vibe. I think they're going to try to go the same route as take a page out of, like, Universal, because Universal Studios has several parks that seem to be geared towards the Harry Potter crowd, and the Harry Potter crowd seems to be able to hit that whole age range, from the adults who loved reading through the books and watching all the movies to all the kids who read all the watched all the movies and maybe now are starting to go through the books. And it seems like I've never been there, but from what I've been told and from what I've seen in pictures from there, all it basically is trying to recreate parts of the movie and, you know, places that you can actually walk around and see and interact with those type of characters. So maybe it'll be like the cantina on Tatooine, or I don't know, maybe walking down the hallways of the Death Star with a bunch of stormtroopers walking around. I'm sure there's a lot, that there's so many probably places and parts of those movies that you can probably recreate in small bursts here and there that would make it very engrossing for both adults and kids.
That's another thing they mentioned, that if you go to the New Order, it's going to be a very sterile, like moon base type environment. Whereas if you go with the Resistance, you're going to be sort of more of a jungle based type environment, which of course will all still be indoors. But the Resistance will be very much this floral area, natural and built in the caves or whatever, whereas the New Order is going to be all metal walls everywhere.
Be like the difference between living in a submarine or living in a thatch hut.
Pretty much, yeah. Though I can't imagine still Disney parks trying to put people up in thatch huts, but probably there's a, like I said, there's a lot of this that needs to be fleshed out, because Disney's always been about hospitality, and I can't imagine your server coming over and giggling, yeah, there's the guy that crashed the Millennium Falcon.
Yeah, I can't see that either.
The other thing, I'm glad you brought this. This was the other thing I wanted to mention, and this is new. At least I hadn't seen it before, and the trailer just dropped on YouTube in the last couple days. They're going to make a Voldemort movie. It looks like a series of them, as told from the perspective of a wizard investigator who's trying to, apprehend Voldemort and bring his evil plans to an end, and of course set years and years before Harry Potter, just after he went from being Tom Suttle or whatever it was to the Voldemort, and then wizard murders start happening. So I don't know, I know with Fantastic Creatures, Rowling actually wrote another novel, obviously the all the money in the world is not quite enough and for the studio. So, but I haven't heard anything about her writing any Voldemort novels. This seems to be something that's just dropped out of the sky. So I'm thinking, the studio has said, no, we are not going to let the gravy train die. We are going to get our own writers. And we own the characters, so we can do what we want with them.
Does Universal own the characters now?
Well, I assume there must be some kind of deal. Either that, or they just backed up the money truck to Rowling's door again.
Which may be.
You'd think they would have to have some rights to the characters just for the theme parks. And what's funny is, if you go through the videos on, on Walt Disney's original plans, I mean, most of the stuff he planned, like the Haunted House and all that, was going to be a walking tour through it. And they figured, no, we have to put people in a vehicle and artificially set the pace, or they'll never leave. So, originally Pirates and the Haunted Mansion would be places that you walk through at your own pace. And I think it's interesting you see these videos of the queue lines for all the stuff. The Harry Potter stuff seems like a lot closer to what Walt had in mind. I mean, if he could unfreeze his frozen head and see all these talking pictures on the wall, it'd drive him nuts. And some of these rides, like the visit to Hogwarts or whatever. You're walking through this queue line for like 30 minutes, and then you actually get on the ride, and it's 5 minutes long, and you get to the end of it, says, oh, well, welcome to Hogwarts. Don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but it almost seems like it's less about the rides with the Harry Potter stuff at Universal, and more about the emerging the people into the whole Harry Potter universe, like they're actually there. My brother and my sister-in-law went down there around about the beginning of the year. And I saw some of the pictures and I talked to them a little bit about it, but they were talking about, like, everything I saw, it just seemed like they were, they were going into Hogwarts. They were going into, like, the you could actually go to the, they had a shop that was some shop that was, I've seen, like, the first movie. I've never read the books. I think Harry Potter is fun, but I've never gotten interested in it enough to actually put the effort into watching all the movies. But it seems like it's more of, like you said, it's a lot more of the walking around. It's more of immersing them in that world than it is like rides.
And the best part for Universal's, all the walking around part is to sell you or your kids stuff. I mean, you're not going to get your kid out of there without buying them a wand, and you're going to be giving them butterbeer. And probably they're going to whine if you don't get them something in the two brothers' magic shop. So every single thing in that place is designed to separate you from your money.
Yeah, and when you're making people walk around like that, I think trying to push the whole food, and if you can try to make food that's, like you said, the butterbeer and stuff like that, that's authentic to the books, then you were really going to sell those things, and you can probably put a good price tag on those things too.
They actually had some soft drinks set up at PenguinCon, and one of them was labeled butterbeer. It was okay, it was like maybe you took some real tangy Sprite and added buttermilk. Well, that doesn't sound so good, but it was a lot more like a lemon lime drink than I would have liked. Now, I don't know if that's representative of what they actually have at the parks or not.
I want to say I've seen it before, but I've never actually tried it before. At least not that I can remember.
I don't think you can officially get it outside the parks. That'll be the next thing. You go into Kroger and buy a six pack of it.
Well, it's basically just kind of like a craft soda, isn't it?
Yeah, what I had at PenguinCon is a lot, I guess it's just that it's a lot of cross between, say, Sprite and a cream soda.
Just judging by the name, I'd guess more like cream soda-ish.
Well, what I had was very, very tart. They could have backed that off a little for me.
Now, the one you had was more soda-esque as opposed to, like, actual, like, beer?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay. Yeah, I want to say I've at least seen it in, like, some where they have craft sodas and type of area.
And one thing, I never even tried it yet, and I should at PenguinCon, but they always have a session on, is it open soda or whatever, but how to make, here's the recipe to make your own cola. Open cola, that's it.
Now, do they use, like, they have those, you can buy at, like, Bed Bath & Beyond, those little machines that will carbonate the basically, you're given the little mixture of the whatever you're going to make, whether it's a little squirt bottle of, like, cola, of the syrup for the cola, and then you add the, plug it up to the machine, and it adds the fizz type of a thing, or is it, I don't know, I know how to add carbonation to beer, and that's pretty much you add sugar to the already yeasty product, and that causes the carbonation when the yeast reacts to the sugar, that creates part of the carbonation.
Right, and the alcohol. The yeast eating the sugar creates the alcohol. I don't know if the carbonation has more to do with the bacteria or something. I need to get back. Well, I never have actually made my own beer. Something I need to get into, because there I was on a podcast about homebrew for a year and a half. Now podbrewers. The colas that they had out, and I said open cola wasn't one of them. But there were like four colas in the hospitality suite. And you know, then they had beer too, so I was less interested in the colas. But, you know, the way they were doing is just like you would normally do it in retail. They had the big, you know, the big, tall, thin, well, keg may not be the right word, but the cylinders of the carbonation.
And that's probably the best way to go. Now, welcome, Netminer.
Welcome.
Have either one of you ever looked at any of the smartwatches that are out there?
I've looked at them. I just cannot justify them at the price that they are, because I would want to do more things like that I would do on my phone. There's a few things I can see, maybe control your MP3s or whatever, but I usually use a separate media player. One thing that nobody's done, I don't think. I would love to have one that would have a constant scroll on IRC. And I used to talk more in All Cast Planet than I do anymore, and I used to monitor it more. And people used to be in there more. I mean, they used to be, if you didn't watch it while you were eating lunch, you're sure to miss something. Where it's not quite like that anymore, but. You know, half the apps that they always have for by default for those things are ones that, well, I never used to have any interest in. I guess I'm on Facebook now, so, you know, there used to be the four core apps, and like one of them be Twitter, which I don't use. So, you know, and I'll talk about links in the show notes. There's actually Kit, this one maker company that I wanted to talk about, but it is this big bulky huge thing. It'd be like it's probably half an inch tall and an inch on each side, and the screen doesn't even cover the whole surface. So yeah, you could make a smartwatch with it that would have functionality of most of your other smartwatches and do it for like $60, but you know, you'll be wearing this big cube on your wrist.
So I don't know where I all of a sudden got it stuck in my head, the possibility of buying a smartwatch. And I don't want to get something like the Samsung smartwatch, or obviously I don't want to get the Apple smartwatch, or anything like that. And I do agree with Jay Lindsay. I think it is kind of a fad item. But at the same time, they have these cheaper ones, like the ones that are geared more towards like the fitness, the heart rate monitors and the sleep monitors and all that stuff. But at the very, which I don't need like the heart rate monitors and all that, but at the same time, if I can have a very simple thin, like the bands, because those are all like thin bands with a very small display that can give me, you know, obviously the time. If it's a little bit fancier, maybe it'll give me the weather. If I get a phone call in my pocket, because ever since I went through the whole process of trying to buy a house and stuff, I've had my phone with me all the time now. I used to leave it in the car when I was at work, and then when I go out to the car, I would get all my notifications and everything. But lately, I've been having my phone with me, and there's occasional times where between my wife and I, usually there'd be something that would come up that she would text me about in the middle of work, and like sooner or later I would get to it. Or there are times when I'm getting phone calls from doctors and other things like that. You know, once you start getting older, you're going to need to get a doctor's appointments start to become a little bit more important. So in making appointments, a lot of times it become a little bit more important. So, you know, notifications, if I can have one of these cheap little ones that are like the thin bands that will give me, you know, SMS notifications, will tell me when there's a phone call and tell me who it is, and at the same time work as a functional alarm clock. And, you know, the thinner ones won't give me like calendaring or anything like that. But, you know, it's basically what I'm looking for is notifications from it. If it can control the media, my media player too, that's pretty cool. But, and there's a bunch of them out there from anywhere between like $12 to like $35 and all sorts of things, but I don't know. I keep looking at it, but at the same time, I'm not sure if I could do it. And let me explain, could do it, because when I work, for the longest time, I've had a watch that I clipped on my belt, because anytime I've had a watch on my wrist, I usually wind up banging the heck out of it, and either it just kind of scratches it up a little bit, or with the ones that are a little bit cheaper, I've just smashed the hell out of them. I'm worried as to whether I can actually wear something like this and not break it. So that's why I was looking somewhere around the cheaper range that just has minimal functionality. And I don't know. Like I said, I got this myth with me. I'll occasionally get a little bug in my head with something like this, and next thing you know, I just start traveling down the road of looking through absolutely everything on like Amazon related to this. And right now, I'm debating on pulling the gun on one of those cheaper, like $25 health band things, or looking at, and this will be completely off that, which is the Pebble. And the Pebble, which would be, it falls in the realm of cheaper, but at the same time, it was bought up by Fitbit about like a year ago, and they've stopped. I think they have until like the end of 2017 when they stopped doing support for it, but I'm not sure what the heck support would be. I mean, as long as I can get the watch face, the choose a watch face, choose the what type of notification type things I want, and maybe control my media, then I'm pretty much set. I'm not expecting this thing to do much more than that. If I can get a little bit more than that, that's fine. And then I go back to my other point of, could I wear something like this and not beat the hell out of it or break it within like the first couple of days? But that's my thought. That's what I've been thinking. That's where my little head's been going lately, and I didn't know whether anybody else had any experience with the smartwatches, whether they've looked at any of them before, whether they've looked at any of these little health band health monitors, and whether they've whether they're any good, whether because there's a wide range of anything between like the Kay Wisher was talking about the Fitbits. The Fitbits are like the more popular ones, but those start, I think, at like $35, and they go on up to the $200 range. But they have cheaper ones that seem to be comparable, because I just want notifications. I want a time, and I want my notifications, and I want it to be not big and bulky. And hopefully durable enough that I can not break it. And try searching for smartwatch and durable, because I have yet to find anyone to actually do a review of a smartwatch that's not going to break when you smash it against something by accident.
Well, frankly, I'm holding out for the smartwatch tattoo. But until then, ever since I've started carrying a cell phone, and this was back, as far back as 82, not 82, I'm sorry, 98, okay, gee, no, 2008, and that was, I basically started carrying a cell phone when my mom started going downhill, because I didn't want to be any place where I couldn't be contacted. And I thought, till then I laughed at people with smartphones, even though they were not smartphones, cell phones, period. And they were well entrenched by then. And, because I said, why would I ever need to, have a phone in my pocket? But I digress. Ever since then, even before smartphones, cell phone has pretty much been my de facto watch. I mean, I get the cell phone out and turn it on and look at it and see what time it is. Yeah, that's not as easy as looking at the watch on my arm. But, like you're thinking, when I'm out working on the farm, you know, I don't want to wear, watch where band breaks and it fall, you know, it falls in the lake or in the mud or, you know, worse things that I have to work around. You know, if it goes someplace I can't retrieve it, I don't want to be wearing a watch that, you know, I've just lost $75. Or even $35, you know. So I've been buying the cheap ones. And when I first started wearing watches, I've always been a lot more comfortable for me to wear something like a Twist-O-Flex band, you know, one of the flexible links, metal links, rather than one that you pulled it up and it was, you know, just tight on your wrist. But the thing is, you know, it's cheap watches, and I mean, there's a lot of them now. You know, when the flexible metal bands came out, you know, you had to pay, you know, buy the watch and then buy that band for like $35. And they worked pretty, the good ones worked pretty well. And then there were the cheap ones on the $5 watches. And those things, you know, eventually got where you got them, and they, you know, they would come apart once every day, and then you'd have to try to get out your needle nose pliers and put them back together again. And that's what put me off wearing a watch. No, I don't need that. And I got one of the normal bands, you know, they would break apart too. The pins would come out or whatever. So that got just to be so much hassle keeping a wristwatch on. I just said, no, I'll just look at the cell phone if I need to know what time it is. So it's been a long time since I've worn a watch of any kind. And, that's definitely a factor. Actually, well, I guess they must still make them. I kind of regret I didn't get one of those, watches from the multi-tool people. The good ones, you know, where every link in the watch was a different tool, and you could get one specifically for computer repair.
Yeah, my watch, I use stopwatches as sort of pocket watches hanging around my neck.
Yeah, I've done that before too. You know, every once in a while you'd get one of those, a premium with something, and, you know, just shove it in your pocket. Yeah, I've done that before too.
See, and So, I think one of the reasons why my mind has gone down this path was recently my little clip watch, the battery has gone on it. And by the looks of it, I can change the battery on it, but the way this thing is set up, it's going to be kind of a pain in the butt. It's four tiny little screws, which is fine. I have the screwdrivers for it, but the band is kind of goes right over it, so I got to get these four little screws off. I got to be able to lift it up just enough, and it seems like it's going to be a pain. I can do it. I'm probably going to wind up having to do it because I'm not sure if I'm going to pull the trigger on one of these smartwatch type things. But I am got myself so used to, I just kind of have to look down and then it's right there. To fish a phone out of my pocket while I'm at work all day long, it seems like a pain. That's why I kind of leaning towards something where it's on my wrist. And if at the same time I can get my notifications too, then that's just a plus, you know.
Actually, no, I never got anything out of it. They never built it. Years ago, I contributed to a Kickstarter, you know, with a ring watch. And I hate rings, so I don't know why, but it just seems so cool that you know. And the one I contributed to, it was expensive enough, and all it did was tell time. There was one that would signal your notifications.
See, and that's another thing that set me down the path is I brought on Tuesday. I had turned on YouTube because I was going to try to find something for my son to watch or some music for them to listen to or something. And the first thing on there was five tech things that you can buy at Amazon or that are available or new tech things you might not have seen before or something. I don't know. And the first one on there was a watch that told time, and if it was basically just a band and it kind of lit up where, like, you know, what the hour was, and then the first row was the hour, and the row underneath it was the minutes. I thought that was kind of cool, and that kind of sent me down this rabbit hole.
And Leatherman, that's the name of the brand of the multi-tool I was trying to think of, not that it's relevant, but anybody does find that intriguing. I think they did make, it was like a Kickstarter type deal, but I think they, pretty sure they eventually did make it, and so you should be able to find that tool watch band.
Well, I have something from a blast from the past that's regenerated, and the phrase now for something completely different.
Well, please share.
Arca OS, a retread of IBM OS 2, is shipping now. The personal edition is $99 for the first 90 days, 6 months of support. The professional edition is $229 with a year of support. Somebody has actually gotten IBM to release the OS 2 binary and licensing capability and to hack it up on modern hardware.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I came into Linux because I was a big operating systems geek. I had the BIOS installed, where you boot into Windows and you boot into BIOS, and you know, then after you did that, you played their BIOS, you couldn't really find much to do with it. But I had it on there, and I played with Warp. Main trouble I had with Warp, I was trying to decide between going with it and Windows 95. And I installed Warp on my system. I don't know if it was Pentium 1 or Pentium 2 at the time, something like that. And, you know, half my peripherals stopped working, modem and whatnot and all that. So I called the support number and, you know, said, hey, you know, my stuff doesn't work. What can I do? And I said, well, you've got to get your peripheral OEMs to write drivers for OS 2 Warp. And I said, well, they're not going to want to do that because all this stuff already works in Windows. You know, I'm not going to jump through extra hoops. You know, I would really like to use your product. I would like to have something alternative to Windows, but no, I'm not gonna buy this or use this. So I think Warp was probably free back in the day, at least for a while. I said I'm not going this direction. If my stuff's not gonna work, and my experience with peripheral manufacturers is they don't care.
Well, this is first 32-bit only, but I have a single core P4 here, which should be a great warp machine because it's even more lightweight than Linux these days.
Well, yeah, if they were just giving the ISO away for free, I would definitely slap that on a machine and play with it, but I'm not going to pay them for it.
Well, I might, just to wrap the machine up as a functional machine. There's a lot of open source stuff being ported to it.
Well, I hope if you do, come back here and report on it to us. You know, I'd be interested to see if there's something out there lighter than Linux.
There's a Lung Duke Hour interview on it, and he's promising a review. But I haven't seen an actual review of it, and I'd like to, before I throw cash at it, I'd like to see a review.
Yeah, and I don't usually do video podcasts, unfortunately, because I would like to get, I'm sure he's got a lot of stuff that I'd be really interested in hearing.
And there's some backstory, but again, it's all from the manufacturer. It's not, there is a OS2 Ecom station, which is another retread, but a little more expensive for business and for industry. By the same outfit, I guess, that has been out there sort of in the weeds for a long time. Just nobody hears about it because it's all very, very niche. It's a DVD-sized installation. Every DVD is custom-built for the licensee. And you fill in your details. They send you a download link. You download it. You put it on DVD, or they'll put it on for you if you don't have the capabilities. But the deal is for an extra charge, of course. But it is definitely old school IBM. And because it's IBM, licenses are real for every bootable instance, whether it's real or virtual. But getting IBM to get the stuff out of the closet must have been a trick. Also, OS2 Warp has very little to no source code. These guys are hacking it in at the binary level and are patching the hell out of it. They've got a symmetric multiprocessing kernel, support for a lot more memory, larger disk, long file names, whatever. But it is all being hacked more or less from the binary. Patch City.
Yeah, I just can't see corporate doing a buy-in on that if they're not comfortable with Linux. I could see most of your managers being really skeptical about this. But I mean, it's cool. I wish them all the luck and success in the world, because what we need is more competition and more diversity out there rather than less.
Well, actually, what they're doing and what their market has been ever since 2004 when IBM cut the cord on Warp is there are a lot of industrial systems, banks, both teller machines and your internals that run on OS2, and it's been running on, 486 or whatever they can keep cobbling together. These guys make their money from people who are up to their eyebrows in OS2 for some random process and would rather fight than switch.
Okay, now this makes a whole lot more sense, that they're already running OS2 and that's what they know. I can't see anybody wanting to switch to Windows or Linux, but if everything they have is built for OS2, and most of your point of sale and your automatic teller machines, things like that. Companies are like, no, because of course they've already made their money. They're not putting any investment in, and they're just still raking in the licensing fee every year. And of course they don't want to go to the later version of Windows. They don't want to pay to put a new motherboard in these things. They just want you to keep coming back year after year and pay them for sitting on their hands.
Well, the thing is that because you're dealing with 486 / P1 era hardware, what these guys are doing is allow you to get a modern motherboard and drop it into whatever, modern being modulo, whatever you can currently scrounge off eBay or whatever. So people who have to support them in customer sites now have an option besides that creaking old 486 with, you know, 32 megs of memory.
And right, someday somebody's going to let the magic smoke out. Now what do they do then?
Yeah, it's a bit. I follow digital follow-ons, and there's a lot of stuff like that just to keep things running that were engineered back in the dawn of time.
Well, we're nearly an hour in. Do we want to start the show? I guess, Honky, you hosted last time, so I guess it's my turn.
Well, you're the one bringing the topics this week. Do you want me to do the hosting?
Well, if you don't mind, I'm playing with a my topics are really light, so they're, you know, there's one I might want to add at the end, talk about a little something I should have been working on in the last couple weeks and just have not found the time to do it. So, it's a Freedom Box. I've got it installed. I'm into the web interface, and I'll wait till we get through the other topics before I talk more about it.
Okay.
SMLR 2.0 is the revamped Sunday Morning Linux Review with Tony Bemis, Mary Tomich, and Tom Lawrence. On even episodes, we cover distro fever and tech news. On the odd episodes will be fresh looks where we review a distro or software or tips and tricks. Live recordings are bi-weekly. Sunday morning on both Google Hangouts on air and audio-only stream. Visit smlr.us for all the shows and the live recording schedule.
The Linux Link Tech Show. Tune in to the world's longest-running Linux podcast live every Wednesday, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Find us on the web at www.twlts.org or email us at techshow@thelinuxlink.net. IRC server, thelinuxlink.net /techshow. Join Pat, Alan, Link, and Joel. And don't forget the two Dans. They are so hot. I know, because I've kissed them both. And Blindridge, he's a bloody drunko.
If you don't like the cats, you can stick it up your ass. Ain't no funny duddies that are linking bad.
G'day, my name's Jude, or better known as Mrs. 64. Hacker Public Radio needs your help. They're running out of shows. If you ever thought you'd like to contribute or do a podcast yourself, here's your chance. Come on, Hacker Public Radio needs you. If you think you're going to sound silly or not going to sound like you know what you're doing, think again, because it never seems to stop my husband. It's easy, and if you live in the USA or the UK, it's as simple as picking up the telephone and phoning the call-in number to record a show, or plugging in a mic and opening Audacity. Get over to hackerpublicradio.org/contribute.php.